Hallo liebe Weitesfeldhörer, das sind ja wirklich verrückte Zeiten gerade. Wir befinden uns mitten in der Corona-Krise und ich habe ein bisschen wenig Zeit in letzter Zeit investiert, um neue Podcast-Folgen zu produzieren, weil ich damit beschäftigt war, mit einer Kollegin aus der Schweiz, Christine Thielemann, ein neues Podcast-Format und mittlerweile sogar ein ganzes Online-Portal auch mit Blog zu produzieren, das sich damit beschäftigt, wie sich jetzt gerade vor allem die Musikpädagogik in Zeiten dieser Corona-Krise verändert. Wenn ihr wollt, schaut doch gerne mal vorbei unter www.motivation-musikpädagogik.de. Jetzt aber zur heutigen Folge. Ich habe vor einer Weile ein Gespräch gehabt für Weitesfeld im Podcast mit dem Komponisten Dave Molk aus den USA. Dave ist ein super spannender Komponist. Ich habe kürzlich die deutsche Erstaufführung seines Stücks Dreams für Percussion Ensemble und Live-Elektronik aufgeführt und bin eigentlich auf ihn aufmerksam geworden, als ich im Blog New Music USA einen super spannenden Artikel gelesen habe, in dem er sich damit beschäftigt, warum eigentlich die gesamte traditionelle Musiktheorie-Pädagogik nur auf alten weißen Männern und den ganzen klassischen Komponisten beruht, die wir so kennen, und warum gerade da die aktuelle und so relevante Musik, wie zum Beispiel Rap, überhaupt keine Rolle spielt. Das finde ich super interessant und das fand ich so gut, dass ich ihn gleich gebeten habe, für die Patreon-Förderer von Weitesfeld noch einen Blogpost zu schreiben. In dem hat er sich auch mit dem Thema auseinandergesetzt und hat sich vor allem auch nochmal so ein bisschen konkreter in Richtung zeitgenössische Musik gedanklich bewegt. Das heißt, wenn ihr Lust habt, diesen Blogpost auch zu lesen, und ich habe ihn sogar auch als Podcast-Folge einsprechen lassen, das heißt, ihr könnt ihn entweder hören oder lesen, dann werdet doch Förderer des Podcasts auf Patreon. Und zwar findet ihr die Seite unter www.patreon.com/weitesfeld. Und schon für wenige Euros im Monat könnt ihr da das Projekt Weitesfeld unterstützen und gleichzeitig Zugang zu ganz vielen Bonus-Episoden, Videomaterial und so weiter bekommen. Ich würde mich freuen, euch dort zu treffen und wünsche euch jetzt erstmal viel Spaß beim Zuhören. Hey Dave, nice to have you here as a guest in Weitesfeld, the podcast.
It's a pleasure to be here. Thanks for inviting me.
We're quite a long way away from each other. What's the time now at your place?
It's 9:12 in the morning.
Okay, so that's okay. We both have our coffee, you know. I have my 4 or 5 p.m. coffee and you're your morning coffee. Perfect time for a Skype session.
Yeah, couldn't be better.
We first got in touch when I recently performed one of your pieces for percussion ensemble and electronics. Your works have been performed by famous ensembles. You can read it on your website. It's like So Percussion or the Decoder Ensemble. But as I found out, your first steps in the music business have been in a rock and jazz genre. So looking at this starting point, which steps did it take you to become a composer of contemporary music from this starting point?
So it's been a long trip so far. I actually started with classical when I was really young, but I never practiced. I was doing classical guitar. And then when I started high school, I switched to electric and got more serious about it. And, started with doing some Southern rock, Allman Brothers, that sort of thing. And then I got really, really into Phish. And that was sort of the gateway for me to start thinking more about jazz and bluegrass and a lot of the other types of music that Phish incorporates into what they do. And so in college, I was doing almost exclusively rock and jazz and fusion and jam band and all that sort of thing. And then I finished that degree. That was math and economics. And then I went back to school for a second undergrad degree for music. So it's already getting long in the telling and it keeps going. So I was doing jazz performance on guitar and ended up dropping out of school to focus on gigging. And after that, I had really bad tendonitis in my left arm, And so that meant that I wasn't able to play. And so I was having this sort of identity crisis and trying to figure out what I was going to do with myself. And so I went back to school after that, back into the same school. This was Berklee College of Music, but switched programs to composition and got the degree there, and then did a master's and then a doctorate, all in contemporary composition or new music or whatever we want to call it. And that essentially got me into more, well, as I said, into contemporary composition.
And have you started? Because I mean, when we think about studying contemporary composition, I'm sure you also have to pass an entrance exam or something at Berklee to start this. When was your first steps into composing your own music, and how did they look like?
Sure. So I was in high school, writing a bunch of tunes, and I didn't know how to read or notate at that point. So I was just recording stuff into this sampler essentially. And then I had MIDI capabilities on my guitar, so I was making the guitar sound like a kind of bad trumpet and that sort of thing. And then when I was at Berklee, especially when I went back after the tendonitis, is when I really started focusing on more the notated type of music that we tend to think about when we think about contemporary, which isn't to say that contemporary is all notated by any means, but as a sort of the academic type of music that a lot of people tend to think about, it's heavily based in notation, and so that's when I started doing that.
And as I found out, many of your compositions deal, besides the acoustic instruments, also with some kind of electronics. Is it because of this jazz and band background, maybe? Because your pieces often contain these parts, or how did you start to experiment with this electronic compositional field, you know?
Sure. So that was maybe a little bit influenced by jazz and by fusion, but I think it was much more influenced by electronic dance music. And my gateway to that was Skrillex. And
Skrillex.
my nephew played me some. This is a very vivid memory. I was in his house, and he played some Skrillex. And I looked at him, and I was convinced that his computer was broken. It was just like unlike anything I had heard before, and it was so weird. And I thought it was, I just could not understand why anyone would listen to it.
Skrillex is doing this dubstep kind of thing, right? Okay, for the listeners who
Like
might
sort of
don't
the,
know.
yep, yeah. So he's, well, yeah, we don't have to go into that yet. But anyway, I listened to more Skrillex, and then through him, I started listening to, I wanted to know where this was coming from, so I started listening to more of the other genres of electronic dance music, and got into old techno and really interested in finding out the roots of where this music came from. And at this point, I wasn't really writing any electronic stuff. I still thought of these two worlds as separate. I wasn't really sure why I was keeping them separate. And eventually, the sort of why am I not incorporating them one to the other just became too much of a question to ignore, and so I started experimenting more with bringing some electronics into acoustic stuff. And I haven't done a whole lot of that yet. What I do now primarily is still stuff that is acoustic, and then I've been working on a lot of electronic productions, a lot of dance tracks in various genres. So I haven't yet focused on melding the two worlds, but it feels okay. I'm happy with what I'm doing now, and I just think about it as two or three or four different sorts of things that I'm making instead of feeling like I have to combine the two. So the piece that you played, Dreams, is it's one of the few that actually is you could call it electroacoustic or whatever, that has both elements at the same time.
And Especially when performing Dreams, I was thinking of this story you told right now with the dance music. It remembers one very much of this dance music character.
Sure. Good. That was the hope. So I'm glad it came across.
Yeah. Thinking of you composing such a new work like Dreams or something else, how is the formation process of a composition when you work on one? I mean, that might be pretty different from work to work, but just for the listeners that might be interested in how a composition starts and how it evolves when you work on it.
Sure. So the for lack of a better term, the new music sort of stuff that I do is it's primarily commission driven at this point, and so I'll have someone or a group of people approach and say, you know, we want you to do a piece for, you know, blank, and then we'll talk about what that blank is, and so this number of instruments, this long, this sort of character, and so that puts some parameters on it. And I'm a really big believer in the importance of building community within the different spaces that I'm in. And so with commissions, I don't like the idea, and again, this is a personal thing, but I don't like the idea of someone saying, hey, I want a piece, you know, here's the contract. And then a couple months later, I send them a piece, and you know, that's the sum and total of the interaction we've had. I'd much rather have it be a conversation. And I'm still figuring out how the best way to do this is, but I want to know. So it always starts with me asking a bunch of questions of the performers, and ideally I would sit down with them and talk, but I want to know more about them as people as opposed to just them as, you know, someone who's going to play a drum set or someone who's going to play vibraphone or whatever. So we kind of shape together the form of the piece or the general aesthetic, and then I will I'll start working on things, and usually I have enough at that point to get a general sense of how to start. And my starting process really is, I wish I was more efficient at it, but it's throwing down a whole lot of like total garbage and being really strict about letting it be garbage, not being my own worst critic right at the start. And once I've generated a ton of material, then I start editing, and I find that the editing is really where the actual, well, I don't want to say the actual process of composition because it's all important, but that's where the shape of the piece really starts to emerge, and I sort of understand what things are going to look like. And throughout that process, I try and check in with the people whom I'm writing for and make sure that it feels like it's going to work for them and so on and so forth. So that is the... Does that make sense?
Absolutely, sort of absolutely. Process. Yeah, yeah.
Cool. And then with more of the dance stuff, a lot of it is driven by samples, really. So if I'm doing a sample-based work, you know, I'll just find something that sounds cool, and then I'll figure out, sort of build a track around that. So it might be a sample of a synth arpeggio that I'll chop up and rearrange, and or it could be a pad that similarly I'll, you know, pitch down and I don't know, bit crush or whatever to change the actual character so that it's not just a stock thing necessarily, although I don't think there's anything really wrong with that either. But for me, it's more satisfying to take something and then really start twisting it and personalizing it and then building the music around that. So the two approaches are fairly different. I'm sure if I thought really hard, I could at least BS connections between the two, but I haven't thought much about it. So for me, there's sort of different processes that I use.
Yeah, it's great to get to know more of this working process. You also have a PhD from Princeton University. And I mean, it's pretty different in some case how you earn your doctorate degree here in Europe or in the US. Mm-hmm. What was your work about, and what did you research about, and how does the final work look like? I mean, did you write a book, or was it more like an artistic research thing?
Sure. So Princeton was, they have a, again, I can't speak with any real authority on this, but my understanding is that the program design is fairly unique, or at least it's in the more the minority in that, you know, we have a couple prerequisites, but really it's about giving us time and space to either figure out our voice if we haven't really stumbled upon that yet, or to further develop ourselves professionally if we have a good sense of the type of music that we want to write. And so my work at Princeton, it was really formative for me in that the first semester there, actually, So Percussion was teaching this seminar with Paul Lansky, and I'd, you know, up to that point, I think the only percussion music I'd written was a cymbal crash in this orchestral piece for my portfolio at Berkeley. And, you know, that was never performed except by the program Sibelius. And
so very famous performer throughout the world.
Yeah, yeah. So I got there, and the class was just totally revolutionary for me as far as thinking about what music is and sort of what music can be. And so at that point, I started writing almost exclusively percussion, which isn't to say that I'm not open to writing other music, but I'm certainly a big fan of really focusing in on the percussion world. And so throughout the program, I was just doing a lot of that type of writing. I took a good number of musicology and the theory classes that were available. The department itself is pretty small, so there wasn't a ton. And then for the work that I guess officially counted for the degree, aside from the coursework and all that, I wrote this. This was a half hour long percussion quartet in two movements. And the first movement is this piece Murmur, which has a fair number of people have heard about at this point. There's a great video by Sandbox out on that Vic Firth put out. And then the second half of that dissertation piece, this is embarrassing, but I'm forgetting the title off the top of my head. Fade to Light, I think is what it's called, which hasn't been performed much, but it's just a sort of continuation of that soft, kind of flickering, delicate world that Murmur is. And so one component of the degree is that some composition of substantial magnitude, and that's really open. So it could be a long piece, it could be a shorter piece, but you know, there's a lot of thought or artistry, and you know, those things are all impossible to measure or prove anyway. But I guess the point is that they're loosely defined so that you can really tailor it towards what you're interested in doing, which is a good thing. And the other component is a research written sort of thing. And so when I was there, I think it was between like 60 to 100 pages was the expectation. And so I was looking at this electronic dance music or musician, his name is BT or Brian Transow. And I was looking at an album called This Binary Universe, where it's all electronic. Well, sorry, it's an electronic album. There's, you know, acoustic instruments in there too. But he was talking explicitly about looking at and using classical form. And so I looked at the album, taking that at face value and thinking about what that means, what it does for listener expectation as you're hearing your way through the pieces. And so I did some transcription of parts of the pieces and talked about those sorts of things. Does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
And then I had to run around to a bunch of departments and get form signed and turn in all my library books that may or may not have been overdue. And then that was that.
And after that, how was your, probably there has been already the start into the music business as a professional, but after your PhD, how did your, career style of work look like? What did you work like, only as a composer, or did you teach also or something like that?
Sure. So I was, let me think of how best to answer this.
I think it's very interesting because, I mean, most composers that I know do so many things at the same time, because it's very often it's not possible to only be a contemporary composer and live from this job. So that might be very interesting for the listeners.
Sure. Well, it's probably going to be a disappointing answer in a lot of ways. But I finished Princeton, and in part, let me start this again. I was on the job market, and I got a job offer from Georgetown. And then it was contingent on my finishing the degree. So I finished the degree at Princeton and then had a 3-year contract to teach at Georgetown, where I was teaching, and this is Georgetown University in Washington, D.C., for listeners who may not know. I was there, I essentially built their theory and composition program, or, you know, redesigned it, which is what they wanted me to do. And so the bulk of my work at that point was going into the full-time job as a professor. And so I was composing and getting some, having some success with there, but the composition part of things, given the time commitment and given the demands of what Georgetown wanted, the composition side of things was definitely a distant second or even third. You know, at that point I was married, and we had our son during that time. And so, being a parent meant that composition again got kind of pushed down in terms of the hierarchy of where time goes and that sort of thing. And I should say, or should have said at the beginning, but I'll say it now, I'm definitely still figuring all this stuff out career-wise. There were kids in the program at Princeton that, you know, were very, very well established in the scene. Andy Akiho was in my cohort, and, you know, his career has continued to really take off, and it's wonderful. I mean, he's a phenomenal composer, a phenomenal person. But even in the program, he was really well established. And I went into Princeton not having ever sold a piece, or not having had people play my music outside of required performances at the school. And so while in the program, through the program, I started meeting more performers and started getting performances that way, and a couple commissions coming in. And then the 3 years at Georgetown, you know, I'd had a couple pieces that had done well. And so people were starting to approach me a little bit more, and I was trying to balance, you know, getting stuff written and also doing the full-time work for the university. So I still figuring this out. Don't have all the answers, and the ones that I have aren't particularly great necessarily, but.
Yeah, but that's great, because I think it's not so often you have the chance to talk about that, but almost everybody has to think about that, because it's not only like you are, I don't know, 14-year-old genius that starts studying his instrument, and with a 17-year-old you're traveling the world, I don't know, being celebrated as something. Most of the artists and musicians develop like this. So it's a very interesting thing about how is it to figure out what to do during the, I don't know, 30s or something like that.
Sure. Yeah, and I'm still really figuring this out. You know, I have an okay idea of how commissioning works in the acoustic, you know, or should stop saying acoustic, in the new music scene. But I have one EP that's ready to go, and another one which we're going to the studio this week actually to start mixing. So I have a bunch of dance tracks that I am trying to figure out how to place with a label or sell. Some beats that I am similarly trying to figure out how to monetize in some way. And at this point, it's mainly been reading online and talking to a couple of people I know who do this. But, you know, otherwise, it's just trying to figure this stuff out on the fly and figure out how to get some additional revenue streams coming in so that I can continue doing this sort of work.
Yeah, that's great. As you're also publishing articles online and maybe in print, I don't know, I just know the online ones. Was it because of this PhD research work that you started off as a writer about musical topics? Or where did this passion, let's say, come from?
Sure. So it it started because our son was a terrible sleeper, and so he was in the bedroom with us when he was young, and I would wake up. I always woke up really early to compose, and you know, that wasn't really an option when he was also in the room, because I, you know, we were all paranoid of waking him up if we were blessed enough to have him actually sleeping for a stretch of time. And so I would wake up and just write prose sort of like by the flashlight on my phone. And it was coming out of, well, this desire to do some sort of creative expression. Also this sort of OCD quality of mine that goes along with that. But at the same time, I was in the middle of teaching, and that entailed a lot of redesigning the curriculum and thinking about curriculum more generally, and pedagogy, and what teaching is, and all that sort of thing. And so a lot of what I was writing at that time is stuff that's now starting to get that I've started to place. So talking about problems with traditional pedagogy and that sort of thing. It's all coming in its origins from these little like handwritten sketches in these notebooks when I was sitting up in the bed trying to breathe really quietly and not make any sound.
Great to have you had this time, because one of the very interesting posts that I found was one of your essays on the New Music USA blog.
Sure.
About the consequence of traditional music theory pedagogy. As I'm super excited that you will write a very special blog post for the podcast community that will be published through our Patreon page that also deals with this topic. I just wanted to ask, I mean, could you give a short overview on the thoughts that you deal with under this topic?
Sure. So let me think here. Sorry, I'm pausing because I don't know if you can hear the dog in the background.
Yeah, but it's no problem. I mean,
okay,
that's the real life, you know.
Yeah,
maybe she wants to go for a walk. It's 9 o'clock, you know.
Yeah, exactly. she's been, very pushy at times. So the my idea on traditional pedagogy and the problems with traditional music theory pedagogy is that, we're using this really small sliver of music that was made by white men and, you know, Europeans, and we're saying that this is really the music that matters. This is the music that's worthy of institutionalization. It's, you know, so this is the music that we study. It's fundamental music that everyone needs to know, regardless of what you're doing in the major. So if you're doing music education or music therapy, you have to do Species Counterpoint. Despite the fact that that has, I was going to say arguably, but I think inarguably, no impact whatsoever on what you're doing career-wise. And there's an awful lot of important musical parameters that we don't talk about within Western art music or the pedagogy. So we don't really talk about timbre. If you open any textbook and you look at the sections devoted on rhythm, you know, it's, if you're lucky, it's 10 pages and 9 of them are just notation. The fact that all we focus on is notation, we don't talk about non-notated music, is also problematic, because students are taking these classes and, you know, Western art music is presented as the thing that we all have to study. It's the important knowledge, which means that everything else is, you know, not as important. And it's really easy to turn that, and I think academia does, you know, this is the valid knowledge, and so everything else is invalid. And so from that you say this is the valid style. This is the style that's worthy of being included. So this other stuff is invalid or it's unworthy. And it's really quick, or it's really easy to go from that to saying, you know, the type of people that made this music are valid or worthy. And the type of people who make this other music are invalid or unworthy. Yeah, just a lot of problems. I think it shapes the way that we think about music and what music is, what music isn't. And I think it does a horrible disservice to students, which isn't to say that, you know, Western art music is bad. I don't think it's bad at all. I think when we present it as the only thing worthy of study, or if we create a hierarchy, if we're going to study rock and pop, but we study them from the framework or from the lens of traditional music theory pedagogy, you know, we're still saying this is the one like true style or the one worthy style, and the other stuff isn't as important, or we understand it relative to this normalized form.
Yeah, I mean, these are so important thoughts. Your article, I was thinking about this many times. I was wondering, you know, the same questions, and your article really opened my eyes, I felt like, because it's so interesting and so important, not to only think about this topic for yourself, but also talk with the students you teach about these things. And as you were talking about your day job work in Georgetown, how do you maybe combine these thoughts with your work in creating these forms of studying composition or something like that?
Sure. So at Georgetown, I created the theory program so that it would address a lot of these problems. So we talked specifically about white supremacy. We talked specifically about traditional pedagogy. On day one, I say, you know, like this class, what this class is and what this class isn't. So I put it in context. And so through that, and we come back to it throughout the semester, I talk about what the traditional pedagogy is. And I explain as we go along why it's problematic. And, you know, so at Georgetown, what we were doing, a polystylistic approach, which incorporated a lot of different types of music, and it wasn't necessarily thinking about them through a Western art music framework, but trying to understand each style within the style itself. And we also spent a lot of time talking about social and cultural issues that surround the music and support the music. So that took place in the form of conversations that I found, you know, when I was adjuncting before Georgetown, you know, during grad school, and then in other teaching jobs before that, even people really come alive when they have the opportunity to contribute. And I think that's really important. And the same sorts of questions would always come up. You know, everyone in any theory class I've ever taught has asked, you know, regardless of the style of music that we're talking about, you know, let's say, well, did Jimi Hendrix know about the pentatonic scale when he was playing this solo, or did Mozart know about this, or did Florence Price know about that? And so I built those type of questions into the curriculum, so we would explicitly talk about them before, you know, a student was sort of brave enough to bring it up. And so a lot of what we did in the classroom was, yeah, that sort of work, just incorporating more big picture issues into the discussions we had. And so that music theory for me was something that I interpreted much more broadly than just focusing on the dots on the page. And I think the problem with focusing just on the dots on the page, just with the dots on the page, is that we think we're being apolitical or neutral, but you're not. You know, when you're teaching Western art music, you're teaching a repertoire that is, if we're really lucky, it's almost exclusively, usually it's exclusively male and exclusively white. And so you're saying, in effect, you know, this is the music that matters. These are the people who matter. And that has a huge detrimental effect on students, and not just students, I mean, has a detrimental effect on everyone to continue to propagate that type of thinking. So the work I was doing in the classroom was really to disrupt racism, to disrupt sexism, disrupt other forms of sort of identity-based oppression, and just make students aware of it. Because this is stuff that I, you know, I'd never encountered throughout all my years at school, and I've, you know, been at school forever. And that is, it's largely by design. There's a you know, an incentive not to talk about this stuff when, you know, I, as a white male, am certainly the most privileged or close to it person in any space that I'm in. So I spent some of the course design too thinking about, you know, like, what would I have liked to have known when I was an undergrad? What would have been important for me? And so I, you know, tried to incorporate a lot of that stuff in the coursework that we did.
Yeah, great. I mean, so important to think about all this, and I can't wait to read your blog post write for Weidesfeld. And also we will record the audio version for it, so all the listeners that are only listening to the podcast and not reading blog posts are also able to listen to it. It's really great. I will put all these links to your articles into the podcast show notes, so the listeners are able to go into all these interesting topics.
Great.
At the end of every podcast, I ask the guest four questions, and here they are. First question is there something that you are practicing or learning at the moment?
Mixing. I am, and specifically that sort of mid-side mixing and balancing, that sort of thing. So I am making, all music, but it's relevant here in terms of the electronic stuff that I'm doing, making it literally in the bedroom, which is you know, sort of the least ideal space to do it. It's not at all sound treated. And so I am really trying to dig into how to mix, but also how to do it, understanding the space that I'm in and the equipment I'm working with, so that when, on some of this stuff at least, when we go to the studio, it's less time and work to get it to the place it needs to be.
Is there any special software you use when it comes to the mixing process?
I do everything in Ableton, so the mixing's there too. Sometimes I'm mixing with headphones, sometimes with different monitors. So there, you know, I've thought about getting some of this, I can't remember now, but there's software you can get that will, essentially take into effect or take into consideration that the particular type of headphones you're using and, you know, the flaws or the biases that are built into those headphones and kind of correct them so that the actual mix that you're hearing is sort of the perfect world mix. As opposed to, you know, the mix through the particular type of headphones that you're having. But I haven't jumped on that. I don't know if I actually will. We'll see.
Okay. What are you reading at the moment?
At the moment, I am reading, it's a book of essays called Thick, and the author is Tressie McMillan Cottom. She's incredible thinker. It's primarily on racism and anti-racism. I started and run an anti-racist book club here in Denver.
Oh, great.
And this is it's been interesting teaching in this context as opposed to teaching music theory. And I'm certainly not claiming that I am any sort of authority on this, and in a lot of ways I'm not the best person to be doing it. But it didn't exist when I got here, and I felt really strongly that it should exist, so we're doing it. But this is the book that we're reading for next week's meeting, so I'm trying to make sure I get it all done and have some sense of how to facilitate the discussion that we're going to have.
Yeah, great. the podcast is hosted on all possible platforms where you can listen to podcasts, but on Spotify especially, I also created a playlist that follows the podcast, and every guest is invited to add one or a few songs that he or she likes to. Maybe there's one song you want to add to this playlist?
I have to think a little bit. I've been listening to this live album by Fortet. It's live at Alexandra Palace. But it's not really chopped up into tracks. So, you know, there's something that's 37 minutes long and then another that's 36 and a half or something. And so if I can put the whole thing on there, then sure. But if not, I'll figure something else out.
No, it's no problem, and, for sure. We put it all on. Cool. Very excited to listen to it.
Nice.
Last question. Very important thing. Every guest, I mean, very often it's the freelance musician or composer that I'm talking to. And all of them, and also you, are doing very much work, very many things at one time, composing acoustic music, composing electroacoustic music, producing electronic music, working at Georgetown, writing blog posts. When you come home after a long day of work, and you need to get your head, I mean, empty, your thoughts to stop. Is there maybe a trick you have? What do you do to calm down after a long day of work?
Let me clarify first and say that I'm not with Georgetown anymore. That finished in May of 2019.
I see.
As far as trips or tricks to come down, my life is a little weird at the moment, or atypical maybe would be the better way to say it, in that I'm freelancing and I'm spending a lot of time taking care of our son, and you know, my wife and I are trading off on who's watching him when. And so for me, when he goes to bed is really the time that I actually sit down and try to do some work. So I don't want to say that there's no downtime. It's a very different way of doing things. And so in some ways, spending time with him is downtime from, certainly from writing music. I mean, I'll think about essays and that sort of thing if I can, but otherwise, it's a way to, you know, just focus in on what he's doing and get my head out of, career stuff and that type of thing.
Okay, great. Sounds like the perfect option to get the head free of thoughts. I mean, it's very interesting. I recently read a book about how children play, and I mean, how do they play without having any special aim at the end of this playing process, and this meditating character of this form of playing. So and in this book they were telling like even adults should learn again to play as a child. Yeah. You know, so it sounds very interesting. And yeah, maybe the perfect way to do that.
That's possible. He likes, so I'll set up a DJ kind of a mix session. So it has a bunch of drum loops, bunch of tracks and clips, so he can, you know, just activate them and do whatever. And his big thing is starting the music and then stopping it and then like speeding it up and slowing it down. So I don't know if that's your way
of getting your work also into the children playing time. I see.
Yeah.
Great.
So I'll take a cue from him, and the next piece will just be start and stop.
Cool.
Start and stop.
Thank you so much for taking your time. I mean, the dog has been waiting very long now for his walk. Yeah. Maybe. I'm very, very much looking forward to your blog post, to the Weidesfeld online blog. Sure. And Patreon. And very much also looking forward to read more of your essays and hear more of your works and compositions. So thank you very much for being guest here, and have a good time.
Yeah, it was a pleasure. Thanks for inviting me. I appreciate it.